Welcoming aboard our friend, writer Colin Fleming, his latest, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro, available wherever fine books are sold. Good day, Mr. Fleming.
How's it going, Hard Rock and Rich Kimball?
Well, I'm just bundled up, hiding behind Kerry. He's a fine windbreaker here. You didn't go out and do your thing today in this Arctic air, did you?
A little bit. I had to go to the CVS, so not too much. But I heard about your dramatic weather drop, your temperature drop there. Your boy looked pretty confident on the porch, maybe a little overconfident the other day, out there in the shorts, and then the cold miser started doing his thing again.
Yeah, well, he's not right. He wore shorts to school today, so he's no indicator of what's ahead.
He should wear shorts to school. I am one of those people, too, so salute your boy for me. Who walks around in shorts? You always see these posts like, why do guys do that? Patriarchy. Men suck. Why do they have the shorts on? I do it because it gives me a mental edge over you and other people. That's what I do. That's why I do it, complainers, because it makes me internalize my Zulu qualities.
All right. We want to talk about a number of things, as always, today. But we begin with, a lighthearted topic here, latent rage. Tell me more.
Latent rage. Did you see that nice screenshot I sent you the other day from the nice woman?
I did. She seemed like a lovely woman to get together with, Colin.
Yes, she was pleasant. So what happened, downtownians, is this woman on a dating site, I've been alone for a long time, and so it doesn't seem like it'll be changing anytime soon, sent me, this is not someone I approached, mind you. I've given up hope. There is no hope to be had. It's very much an abandoned hope, all ye who enter here, situation. If you can spell three words in a row correctly, you just won't find anything. And this woman, who I'd never written, never approached or anything like that, she sent me one of those yellow smiley faces, which I love, of course. Don't I seem like someone you probably should bombard with acronyms and emojis? Rather
Clever words. Right up your alley.
And so she followed that up by telling me how much I sucked, how arrogant I was, how intelligent she was is quite self-aggrandizing, but I took it so far, and she ended a sentence with the word with, and then commented on that saying, I know I ended that with the preposition, bite me. Now, I'm just sitting there, man. Like, I probably cried and vomited that. Well, I know I have. I mean, I don't even need to go through the motions of pretending that I hadn't. And it was someone who was, I would say not in the greatest of fitness is the proper way I should put that, who was widowed. And I felt bad in a way for this person. I deal with endless rancor with my work, certainly, and the industry I'm in. And rancor, which is the worst kind for me personally, because it's not derived from like evil doing on my part. It's derived from virtues and hard work and productivity and expertise and genius and kindness and not drinking and running up and down stairs and fighting on while being alone. All of these things that you think like would be heroic become, in my world, reasons to hate me. So I've noticed that happens almost all the time with someone who's insecure, which is almost everyone now, when they denote an intelligence beyond their own. And you saw how I responded to her, which, you have to understand, this would have made things worse. And I'm aware of that as I do it, of course, too. So I won't even pretend that that's not the case. But just it's not a good way to be. Someone who's not interested in you, who wasn't going to be interested in you, didn't approach you, doesn't deserve your projections and your rancor and your baseless animus, which is obviously something that stems from your own dissatisfaction with yourself.
Focus on that, perhaps. And do you think, Colin, is that where the rage comes from, that we've created a society of people who, because of social media and other factors, measure themselves against what they see out there and find themselves wanting?
Yes, that's part of the reason that's a huge piece of the pie for why I am detested. I mean, you see it up close, you see it in my business. The thing where I do what I do every week and create the works of art and publish all the things, and I write someone who lives in Cambridge or is from Cambridge, is from money, has never done anything in their life, and has done less in a year than I will do in the morning, and they'll never be in the places I'm in, which I get in against great odds and great resistance and blackballing. And they take a look at me and they go to the side, or they already know who I am. They're not letting me in. They hate me because of what I am and what they are not. And people hate the truth. That's, you see this all the time now, like on Twitter. It's like, so-and-so owned this person or dunked on somebody. It's like this contest of the riposte. And that's not how it works. All you would have to do to draw out someone's extreme enmity towards you is to be smarter than they are and say a very practical truth, either about them or whatever you're discussing. That's where, like, all of the rage comes from. No one starts to think, you know what, I should walk around maybe 10 miles and be with my own thoughts, be present in my own thoughts, and work on the person I am, because I don't know that they have a point. I think they don't, but I should look into this just in case. No one's going to do that. I mean, I don't know anyone in my own personal life, with very few exceptions, that if they're fronted with any truth, they don't respond with just lacerating, vituperative rage.
We've talked about this before, and it's in a lot of areas, but in your industry, and publishing in particular, the embrace of mediocrity, but we see it in broadcasting, we see it in sports. What's the basis for that? Why has that become not just the norm, but the gold standard?
People never wish to feel like someone else is on a different plane than they are. That is the ultimate overriding criteria of our society, culture, and human lives right now. And human lives, I use that term loosely, because I don't think very many people live a human life. I think very many people live a passive, craven existence, which to me is a non-life. So that's why you get sort of the main criteria becomes, I could do that, or that person doesn't make me feel like I don't know about something. I make you feel like you don't know about something. Now, I don't do it in a showy, put-you-down kind of way. I do it in a very inclusive way. And the way I think I sound whenever we have these conversations, it's how I sound in the rest of my life. It's how I sound in my work and on the blog. But people look at it and they think, this guy knows everything about hockey, and I just kind of BS my way through it. And people in the media who are so-called hockey experts, they do the exact same thing, because no one knows anything about anything. Everyone knows about Netflix and Doritos on the couch and whining about this and whining about that and Orange Man is bad, but there's not much more in human lives right now. So we end up taking it out on the few people, and who does it really impact? Who are that different from us? And we have this whole society now which is oriented around meritocracy as what you're looking for. Meritocracy is the driver, because it's just a placebo pill that's not going to do absolutely anything to you one way or the other.
Now, this thought just occurred to me, so I asked you, and we haven't talked about this, but we've discussed where you want to be and where we both think you'll be at some point when your work is appreciated and accepted and embraced the way that it ought to be. And when that person comes along that is that perfect match for you, is there at all a concern that maybe those two things aren't compatible, that astonishing lack, the astonishing level of productivity that you've had when you've been alone isn't something you could replicate if you're with somebody down the road?
Oh, I thought you were asking something different. I thought you were asking, like, if I meet that person then when I'm where I should be based upon what my work deserves, would I think that they're with me for the right reasons? Because that is something I always
wonder
about.
Then that too.
As for my productivity, and here's the thing that's going to disturb you. I haven't even gotten started yet being productive. What am I sitting on? This year I've written a book. I've written all the features, all the op-eds, all the blogs. I've written, 20 short stories. I've done most of what I do, though, and you know this, is writing letters to evil, bigoted people. Take that away from me. Make sure that I don't have to do that. That goes away when I am where I should be, and I'm not trying to get paid $150 for money I've been owed for 7 years. That is my life right now. Take that away. You give me 3 hours each day to write. That's 6,000 words. That's a piece of piss. That's a vacay for me. You're going to see someone who's already produced more than anyone has ever produced, which is literally true, who is then writing a book every single week. and without any sweat coming off their brow. So that's not going to be the problem. The problem is going to be, okay, what do we do? This guy has so much product. Now, it fits into all of these different areas, but there's never been anything like this, and we're so lazy. We always think in terms of, how do we market this compared to what's come before? That's why I need someone with vision who can say, this is a guy who has not come before. Let's reap.
Heck, you wrote an unbelievably good story today on a pencil.
Yeah, so you know Norberg, and listeners, Norberg is one of the people, and Rich is one, and Bruce Pratt's another, who are sort of in my inner circle, who see these things and kind of know what's going on, really. They see behind the curtain. They see the email. And I had said to this person I've known for a long time, who's a provost at St. Joseph, Philadelphia, as I'm writing 7 stories a week or whatever it is, and they're not coming out because of the blackballing, which is confusing because, hey, didn't I just see him in USA Today and all of that? And I said half-jokingly to Norberg over the years that I could write a story about a pencil, and because I could write something on anything, and it would just lay you out emotionally. It would be devastating. It would be great art, and it would be something that wasn't like anything you could ever read. And I kind of thought that I would eventually do this, and then today, just to get myself started, before I wrote this op-ed on Dr. Seuss, I ended up writing the story about, I mean, it is about a pencil. It's called Pencil. And it's unlike anything that a person would ever read. It's like, how did he do this about a pencil? And it's like, that's more than what these other people in this industry will write that sucks in a year. And they're not going to like that person who's like, oh, I'll just do this as a challenge to myself and creating something that can stand with anything. You're going to pay a price for that until you don't.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. We have talked on a couple of occasions in the past about yours truly, Johnny Dollar, and this time around, what a great stretch of 5 episodes on the Clinton matter as our man Johnny Dollar makes his way out to Colorado to investigate a suspicious incident at a school.
Yes, and it's from March 1956, so we have an anniversary, and it's kind of like a very wintry setting, wouldn't you say?
Yes,
where
yeah.
You can almost imagine, like, it's a small town in Colorado, which is at like the escarpment of the Colorado Rockies. And I was thinking about this today. We've talked about this show, like you've said a few times. I've made like a rough list of the works of art. I'm like Mr. Art, right? The works of art that have truly infiltrated my being and changed in some measure who I am as a person over time. And that's a pretty short list for all the art that I am immersed in all the time. And it's changed over the years, and certain things have gone away or come back. But that list would be the Beatles, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Stone Roses, the British version of The Office, Orson Welles, Thoreau, William Sloane's novel, To Walk the Night, and Johnny Dollar. That's how good I think this is. I mean, it's really changed my life listening to this, especially these 5-part episodes, which took place over 13 months. So Johnny Dollar goes out to this town in Colorado, and it's run by like a low-level sort of mob situation where this contractor has everyone in this vice grip in the town, and the school was built, and it was built without the right kind of material and to collect the insurance and all, and burns down, and janitor dies, custodian dies inside of it. And Johnny Dollar is there to get to the bottom of all of this. And it's a really intense episode where he even has to call in 8 other investigators, insurance investigators, to help him out. So he becomes the coach/quarterback of this situation, and it's witty, and it's so well written. And as you mentioned another time before, all of the parts, the sound, the music, the effects, the acting, the cadences come together perfectly in this episode that is populist, but it's high art to my thinking.
And those 15-minute episodes are just so tight, so well written, there's not a wasted word.
No, and I try to, like, it boggles my mind how they were able to do this, because they would record them. So you get 15 minutes each of the weekdays, so 5 days right there. But it's every week for 13 months, and there are no, like, flubs, really, from Bob Bailey, the guy who plays Johnny Dollar. And the music, like, they must have been up, like, all night putting this show together. And when he brings in, there's just these great aphorisms too for life that I find useful, but in a way that goes beyond just the merely aphoristic. He brings in these other insurance agents to help him out, these investigators, and he gives them all of this advice about, because people are being intimidated, someone else has been murdered. He gives them advice about going out and getting information in the streets of this town where the people are scared. And he says, don't push anybody around. Don't let anybody push you around. That's brilliant, right? Mm. That's so the pith of that. My father could have said that to me when I was 6, and that would have stuck with me for the rest of my life. And here it is, tucked away in this amazing, artful, brilliant, genius radio program.
Up next, thank you, sir, for giving me the opportunity to go back 41 years to watch the wonderful video I had completely forgotten about, the NHL showdown, watching a 19-year-old Wayne Gretzky match skills with people like Robbie Fatorik, Mike Bossy. Yeah. What a hoot that was.
And Reed Larson's there, and it's telling for a number of different reasons. Like, for instance, well, there's Mike Bossy with his perm, which looks like he looks like Mr. Brady, right?
Yes, yes.
Wrong is like, out for some shinny on the pond, which is like his whole sort of shinny concept. And it's like a shooting drill. It's like the old NHL shooting drill. I don't know if they still do it with the targets that Ray Bourque was really good at, but now there's a goalie. And there's races, but you have to skate backwards during a portion of this race, which messes up Wayne Gretzky and Mike Bossy. And there's a breakaway competition, and you see the difference. I could put a puck, not many, but I could put a puck or two past some of these goalies because there is so much more room to shoot at. And then it's like when you watch an NHL goalie right now on a breakaway, the player gets him to move a little bit, just to open up like a touch. And most people who don't even watch hockey wouldn't even notice it after 10 replays, like a little flip of the wing of the arm type of thing. The goalie is cooked. But back then, 1980, goalies are 3 feet in the air on the breakaway. They're diving. It's like Superman gone amok. And so they have this part where they're in the slot. They get the puck. No one takes a wrist shot because they're all just doing this sort of like inaccurate snapshot thing. And Gretzky's shot isn't strong enough. And he's actually cheating. And they're blowing the whistle because he's winding up for a slap shot. So Bossy, who might be like, what, the greatest pure goal scorer ever, and Wayne Gretzky, who we've talked about is perhaps the best athlete ever, they get schooled in this competition by Robbie Fatorik, of all people, who was like kind of good in the WHA.
Right. Gretzky even got DQ'd in one of them that I was watching.
Yeah, there are all these problems. They're blowing the whistle on Gretzky. He's not getting the lady bang for this particular competition. And I think what it really reinforces, and this is kind of the point that ties together with right now, people like to isolate skills. That's why I never put any stock in draft talk. Like somebody's vertical, whatever it is. But that's not how games are played. And so if you just watch these four guys, and Reed Larson was a pretty good offensive defenseman. He had a stint with the Bruins, but he was on those so-called Dead Wings teams, and he was really kind of their only marquee player. He'd get 20 goals, which was a lot for a defenseman, still is. And they end up going to town on Gretzky and Bossy. But you watch this, you think Gretzky sucks. But Gretzky's like, he's already doing his thing. He's breaking the record, but he understood that it's almost like someone's really good at throwing a chess piece really far, but that's not how chess is played. So this is the throwing of the chess pieces.
Well, it's worth a rewatch on YouTube to check out the NHL showdown from 1980. Finally, with Colin Fleming this afternoon, and I didn't know this existed, a novelization of the great film The Searchers.
Well, it's not strictly a novelization because it predates the 1956 film.
Oh, okay.
So this is a novel from 1954, and the Library of America put out, I think it was, four Westerns from the 40s and 50s in a single volume. Shane was in there, and the Oxbow Incident. And Alan LeMay was the guy who wrote The Searchers before John Ford, cast John Wayne, of course, in the film, created his picture. And I just really think there's a lot of value to be had in what we deride as genre. Like, we've talked about X Minus One, the radio program, and science fiction writing was doing so much that you don't get in, like, I mean, Steinbeck is just such a ham-fisted bore. It's just, okay, it's, you can do more creatively sometimes in genre. And sci-fi was that way, and the Western was that way. And you see it, too, with movies of the Westerns in the 40s and 50s, because you'd think, like, you wouldn't be able to get, like, new material from, like, these odors, this whole concept of man going west in America. And the novel is just has this crisp, cutting prose, and you can see what a storyboarded bonanza it was going to prove for the filmmakers, with a different ending. And it's a very interesting different ending. It's a much more ambivalent ending than we get with, I guess we'd call it a happy ending with the John Ford picture.
Do you consider the Searchers film to be one of the greatest Westerns of all time?
I consider it one of the greatest works of art that anyone's ever made of any kind. And it's funny because I'd mentioned Orson Welles, and I don't know really perhaps what got under his bonnet on that particular day, but he laughed about how poor he thought the film was to Peter Bogdanovich in that book, This is Orson Welles. Mm. And I have a hard time. Normally, critically, I felt like Welles was spot on and uncannily so. So I'm not sure what was going on there, but I don't know how you get much better as a movie than The Searchers. And The Searchers is a great film, too, as a gateway to something better than just the standard Netflix. Netflix is like a prevailing formula. I got rid of the service because it's like everything kind of felt like it had the same beats and the same arc to it. And despite all of like the disparate kind of shows, they were Netflixy. Whereas, like, if you said to someone, look, there's more to life than just, like, these streaming services. Go stream this film. Find it somewhere for free. Okay.ru, the whole Russian site. And you will have a convert. Someone will watch the film, and they'll be like, wow, this is an old film, and I thought it would be boring. And that was thrilling. Because it truly is thrilling. And the themes, of course, right, if anyone out there knows the film or even knows the novel, probably not so likely you know the novel, but if you know the film, it's really a film of right now, isn't it? It deals in dun-dun-dun, race.
And you're right about Netflix, and there are some good things on there every once in a while, but I guess it is what it is. I find a lot of their material fairly disposable.
It follows patterns. There is, like, clearly a blueprint for a Netflix show, and when I could count the number of things I've seen on Netflix that I thought had value. And I'm not like being hoity-toity and recondite and has to have value up here at the top of Mount Olympus. That's not what I mean by value. My tastes are very Catholic, but I need a point and I need humanness. And I can't have the formula of, oh, I know it's going to happen and then it comes. Because that to me is not how anything is. It's not how life is. It's not how art is. It's not how entertainment is. I need to know what's going to happen next and to have it feel like it makes sense when it does and also surprise the hell out of me. That's what I need from what I partake of. And I think that's the art that matters most and the entertainment that sticks. That's why we like A Christmas Carol so much, because it surprises us. So there are all these things out there that it's not like you'd be put off by them or you wouldn't love them more or actually love them. You would not just be partaking of them or doing them, you'd be ensconced in them, but we don't look. And it's so easy. It's like, take your fingers, put them on home row, do a search. It's like, oh, magic, there it is. Look up film noir to check out or overlooked Hollywood masterpieces, and boom, there's your weekend.
Sage advice, as always, from our friend Colin Fleming. Colin, thank you, as always, and we'll visit with you again next week.
Sounds good, sir.
Colin Fleming, Tuesdays on Downtown.